KXLY 920 News Scope with Mike Fitzsimmons.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of News Scope. We're going to launch things with the Attorney General of the State of Washington, Rob McKenna. Several things going on. We'd like to talk with the Attorney General, and you, of course, can talk as well. 326-9200, 800-920-9244. The Attorney General is going to be flying back to the other side of the state here in about a half hour or so, so we've got him for 30 minutes, and we're going to join Rob McKenna in just a moment. Right now, Dave Erickson has the latest news. The Attorney General of the State of Washington, Rob McKenna, joined us in studio. Mr. Attorney General, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to see you. It seems like everybody's suing you these days.
Yeah, everyone's suing the state, claiming they didn't get as much money as they deserved in the last legislative session. I can hardly wait to see what kind of lawsuits come out of the current legislative session.
Especially since they've been cutting, and other folks have been getting something extra. So
they've been cutting, you're right. But in addition to that, the legislature is looking at quite a few tax increases, and depending on how they structure those tax increases, for example, if they try to make some of them retroactive, we may very well see legal fights over those as well.
We're going to talk a little bit with Representative Kevin Parker a little bit later on the program about all those tax increases and such. Do you see any reason why the legislature might extend beyond Thursday?
Yes, they can't agree. The Senate and the House, the governor, are not in agreement on how to close the budget gap. Unfortunately, all three of those corners seem to want to raise taxes quite a bit, but they can't agree on which taxes to raise. The Senate wants to raise the sales tax 0.3 cents, only temporarily, of course, and the House wants to raise a whole package of taxes, which the governor also favors in part. So they're at major loggerheads, and we'll see how long it takes them to sort it out.
Now, let's talk about some of the things that are happening over there as they're going to impact the state a little bit in terms of what your office may have to get involved with. One of the things they're grappling with is this business of basic education.
Right.
And the governor's holding them,
right,
trying to get them to address this. We had a King County court decision just a few weeks ago relative to this, indicating again that basic education wasn't being sufficiently funded, and that that too much pressure was being placed on the local levies to raise money. What I never seem to find in these cases is a reliable definition of what basic education is and what it costs.
Well, the court tried to come up with its own definition of basic education, looking at prior court cases and looking at the legislature's own enactments and looking at bills that they had passed that addressed education. And the court also ordered the state to come up with a plan to fund that level of basic education. But Mike, here's the problem with that decision. The judge looked at all the factors that affect a child's education and said, well, if you just spend enough, every child can graduate, every child can test at the appropriate level. And regardless of what's happening at home, regardless of what's happening in the external environment. And of course, that's a pretty high mountain to climb, to say that basic education means that every child is guaranteed to graduate. You just have to spend enough to get to that point. That would bankrupt us. And more than that, it's not the court's job to dictate education policy. It's the legislature's job. They are the education policy makers. And it's much more appropriate for them to make these decisions than for a judge to try to provide meaning to language written to the state constitution in 1889.
But there's always a reason why the courts get involved anyway. It's because the legislature isn't doing those things.
Well, because plaintiffs, like some of the school districts, claim the legislature isn't doing its job, which means the court is brought in to try to figure out what is meant in the state constitution when it says that it's the paramount duty of the state to provide, to amply provide for the basic education of students. What is paramount? What is ample? What is basic education? And yes, the court has to try to provide meaning to those terms, but let's face it, these are fundamentally policy decisions that the legislature has to make and makes and should be making on behalf of the people. So let's let the political process, let's let the legislative process bring us to answers on those questions, not the courts. It was one thing when in the 1970s the state only covered 10 or 15% of basic education costs and local districts were left to cover the other 85 or 90%. But today the state covers over 70% of basic education K-12 costs. It seems to me any reasonable interpretation obligation of paramount duty would be satisfied with the state picking up a much higher percentage of K-12 costs than is covered in most states.
Now, there's another case pending, of course, which your office has been involved with. This is before the United States Supreme Court, the issue of the disclosure of the names of petition signatures.
Right.
This one, of course, is the arguing is over. The case is now likely to be decided and announced sometime late this spring. Is that right?
Right. Actually, the oral arguments have not been held in the Supreme Court yet. That will happen on April 28th,
okay.
And the court will rule by the end of June. And I'm glad you asked me about this case because it's important for people to understand that this case in the U.S. Supreme Court is not about one referendum.
No.
It came out of this one referendum,
yeah.
But what's at issue is the federal district court, the trial court's ruling that no names on any petition for any referendum or initiative can ever be disclosed under the Public Records Act. That's certainly contrary to our understanding of our own state's law, and the Ninth Circuit overturned that district court, and we believe that the Supreme Court ought to rule that it's up to the state to decide whether, in general, these names can be available or not. Now, if the Supreme Court upholds the Ninth Circuit in overturning the trial court, then the R71 case will go back to the trial court, and he'll actually have a chance to rule on whether or not these names on these particular petitions, these R71 petitions, ought to be not disclosed.
But the tradition in our state and the law has been fairly clear that these are public record and are disclosable.
Yeah.
But does it not trouble you, though, we seem to be in a confrontational sort of era,
yes.
And that in the past no one really cared whose name were on these signatures. It was a matter of due course. Nobody ever, very few ever asked for them. But now all of a sudden there appears to be an ulterior motive as to why people might want these. And indeed, the fear was, in fact, the stated objective was, we're going to call these people and either try to talk them out, but in some way harass these folks whose names appeared on that. That seems to me to be out of bounds with respect to just the respectability of the electoral process. Would you agree?
That's a legitimate issue to bring up in the court looking at a specific set of petitions. And if the court is convinced that in this case, with this petition, there is enough evidence of harassment and intimidation or potential harassment to warrant not disclosing them, that would be a correct decision in that particular case. What concerns us is the very broad ruling that would affect every initiative, every referendum petition. Because the fact of the matter is that we, need the public to be able to check up on the work of government. For example, in the 2004 gubernatorial contest, it was researched by people who didn't trust the results of that election that revealed that 1,700 convicted felons illegally cast ballots in that governor's race, clearly having a dispositive impact on the outcome of that race.
Sure.
And the reason that was possible is that people had access to the voter registration records. We it's public who is registered to vote. It's public whether they voted or not, whether they voted in a particular election. And it seems to me that if those records are public and should be public for purposes of checking up on the work of government, so should petition names be, because Secretary of State might not always get it right, might approve something to go on the ballot that really didn't have enough qualifying signatures. Again, however, in a particular case, if there's harassment and intimidation threatened, there's enough evidence of that, specific petitions could be kept out of public view. It's just this blanket rule the district court made, which you really can't allow to stand.
It seems, however, that we would err on the side of disclosure, because that keeps the open and forthrightness of government.
Yeah.
Whereas there may be reasons why in specific and individual and limited cases we would not do that.
The rule is transparency, but there can be exceptions to that rule if there's enough evidence. That seems to be the right balance, between transparency and privacy.
This is Consumer Protection Week.
All week.
Yeah, and your office has been in the consumer protection business.
We've been very, very busy. We're suing DirecTV for massive violations of the Consumer Protection Act. We've now had a record number of complaints filed against DirecTV, more than we've ever had about any other company in existence. I encourage any listeners who've had bad experiences with DirecTV, who feel they've been ripped off, to file complaints with our office. We receive more complaints every week. So that's a very important suit that's underway right now. Number two, I continue to do a lot of work on the mortgage foreclosure crisis. I'm serving on a national task force right now on mortgage fraud with the FBI, the Department of Justice, and other groups. And number three, we're pushing the big loan servicers, Citi, Chase, Wells, and others, to accelerate loan modifications so that people who are at risk of being in foreclosure can obtain modified terms in their loans in order to avoid being in default and going into foreclosure. So a lot of work being done on that front.
He is the Attorney General of the State of Washington, Rob McKenna. When we come back, we'll talk about the LifeLock case. This is interesting. Stay with us. 326-9200, 800-920-9244. News Gov 326-9200, 800-920-9244. I'm going to ask the Attorney General about the LifeLock case. Very interesting case that his office has been involved in. We have a caller on the line, and let's go to that now. Hello, Sam. You're on KXLY.
Hi there. Hey, Mr. McKenna, I'm just curious. I have a question regarding the state's hardline stance against internet gambling and even gambling all the way down to football pools on the weekend, March Madness pools, yet the state sells its own lottery aggressively, and that's gambling. Excuse me, that's gambling as well.
Right. Well, that's a good point, and I'm not a big fan of gambling in general. When the state decided to get into the lottery business, they effectively opened the door to all kinds of gambling, because that was the legal theory that the tribes used to argue that they're entitled to have casinos. The issue of internet gambling is one that the State Gambling Commission has been addressing, and the reason that they have been going after internet gambling along with other states is that they're trying to enforce the law against criminal syndicates which use internet gambling companies and those web pages for online poker to wash huge amounts of illicit money, including drug trafficking money, through that system. It's basically money laundering, and they have not been able to get at it, in part because they have to enforce the law against all internet gambling to be able to do so. At least that's what they tell me. That's their reasoning for going after, for banning online gambling. Now, obviously, they're not bringing cases against people placing $2 bets in online poker, but that's the overall rationale for prohibiting online gambling. And the other rationale is the state wants to maintain its monopoly, which they like, because it's a major source of revenue for them. So that's the policy rationale.
I'm glad to hear you admit that, because I've seen advertisements on city buses that say something along the lines of even your football pool is illegal on the weekends, and to me that, you know, when I go to the grocery store and I see someone who reeks of cigarette smoke and who probably can't even afford a lottery ticket buying a handful of them, but yet if I'm sending my football pool into my buddy in San Diego on a weekend, I'm actually breaking the law. You know, there's a disconnect there.
Liberals talk about regressive taxes. There's no more regressive tax than lottery tickets. The only difference being people voluntarily buy lottery tickets. But you're right, the state markets that aggressively, so it's creating part of the problem.
Okay. Thank you.
You bet.
All right, Sam, thanks very much. Ron on the line. Oh, Ron, you're on KXLY.
Good afternoon, Mike and Mr. McKenna. Ron the cop here. Mr. McKenna, the Spokesman Review ran an article about a week ago now. This is out of the savage death in the River Park Square parking garage. And in that article, it made reference to a memo that David Savage had written to himself after speaking with your Assistant Attorney General, Scott Marlowe. And I was wondering if we could hear your comment and your perspective on that.
Well, our office was asked to review the Spokane Prosecuting Attorney's Office work on that case to evaluate whether or not, as David Savage had urged, there'd be some sort of manslaughter charges filed because of alleged defects in the structure that resulted in the car plunging over the side and killing the former Mrs. Savage. And our criminal prosecutor looked at the case and concluded there was no basis for criminal charges, or certainly not sufficient basis for criminal charges. And Mr. Savage wrote a memo to himself claiming that our lawyer had said, well, this seemed to be, you know, a review we were asked to do for political reasons. I don't know that Mr. Savage got that right. In any event, we did the work. It was reviewed by the top criminal prosecutors in our office, who double-checked the work of our assistant AG, and everyone reached the same conclusion. There was no basis to bring criminal charges cases, and that was also the conclusion of federal prosecutors who took a look
at it. Was that not, though, predicated on the sum and total of information that you had before you to evaluate?
Right, that's based on the information that was available to us, all, which was all the information
but
we
there,
understood.
There was some question as to whether there was a thorough enough investigation to provide you with all of the evidence you should have been provided in order to make a decision.
I believe we were given everything that the Spokane prosecutor had.
That they had, yeah.
And if the Spokane prosecutor wasn't given everything they needed, I'm not aware of that. But we looked at everything they had, and I believe the federal prosecutors did the same thing. So three sets of prosecutors looked at it and concluded that there was a significant tragedy here. But that there was not basis for filing criminal charges. Civil charges, as you know, were brought, and there was a large civil settlement that resulted from that tragedy.
Right. Brent, hello, you're on KXLY.
Yes. You had alluded earlier to the foreclosure situation, and I'm experiencing that, unfortunately, firsthand. I'm in an industry that was directly really hard hit by this, and in the automobile industry, and I got behind on my payments. My mortgage company was bought out by a large national bank. I don't know if I'm allowed to say who.
It's okay with me. Who is it?
Bank of America.
Okay.
I have had possibly the worst experience of my entire life trying to deal with these people. They bait me into the Obama plan, make me fill out paperwork and refax and refax and refax. I get it all done, get approved on the program. They call me once, leave me a message to call. They send nothing in writing, and they were missing one form, so they kicked me off the program, then put me 3 months behind on my mortgage and in foreclosure.
So,
and I did exactly what I was supposed to. Now, the latest thing is I've made up two payments. Now they want to try me on again on the Obama plan. The Obama plan is a nightmare. I have two other friends. Yeah. No one's pulled it off successfully yet.
Right. I'm hearing that, and I'm hearing that all over the country.
And you can't probably help me because it's the OCC, correct, with the National Bank.
Yeah. No, that's true. It's a problem that we're preempted against the national banks. And the HAMP program, which is, I think, the program you're talking about, was supposed to help 2 million Americans. Fewer than 200,000 have actually gone through the program successfully. It's really not working very well. There are some revisions being made to it, supposedly. The administration apparently is very aware that they're not having much success with it, supposedly going to be making changes to it. You know, if you think you have grounds for a complaint against Bank of America, if you believe that they've treated you unfairly or they've deceived you, you are welcome to file a complaint against them with our office. You know, I can't guarantee you the result, but we're not deterred by preemption, at least from, you know, following up on it. We could try. We might have the door closed in our faces, but if you want to try filing a complaint with us, we'd be glad to try to help you.
I will
you.
Do that.
Yeah.
My experience with them is kind of funny because I'm in an equity position. I only have 9 years. I feel very blessed. I'm towards the end of my mortgage.
Right.
But they see that, and they see me in an equity position, and they pursue me much harder. They have a friend of mine down a year, but he's leveraged his house like a cash machine, and they don't want it back. The different treatment, the banks will be profitable at expenses of guys like me, and I missed my payments. I'll be the first to admit it.
I couldn't
make my payments.
My heart goes out to you. First of all, I really sympathize with what you're going through. I know other people are going through this, people who work like for WaMu and their bank went up in smoke. So you're right. I mean, we're seeing banks take a lot longer to foreclose on some houses, particularly where that property is underwater, whereas you're, in an equity position, and they see that equity sitting there. So do go ahead and file a complaint with us and do try to get back into that program and work through it. If you haven't taken advantage of the free homeowner counselors who are available through DFI's homeownership hotline, I want to urge you and anyone else who's hearing this to call that number. Those HUD-certified housing counselors sometimes are able to help with the paperwork and help get it done. And that's 877-894-HOME, 877-894-HOME, or go to my website, atg.wa.gov, and type in foreclosure, and we'll lead you to the online version of that assistance. But please take advantage of that if you haven't already.
Brent, we thank you for your call. Appreciate it. The LifeLock case. Everybody thinks LifeLock is the safest place in the world to protect yourself against identity theft. You have a different view of that, don't you?
Yeah, I do. They have been making claims that are not supported. In fact, basically claiming that if you you pay them that monthly fee, that you're essentially guaranteed not to suffer from identity theft. And if you are, they're supposedly going to pay you up to $1 million to help you recover. We've been warning people for years that it looks an awful lot like insurance, even though it's not. They're trying to make it sound like it is. And that there is no guarantee, no foolproof way to avoid identity theft. In fact, the owner of LifeLock, the founder, the CEO, became a victim of identity fraud himself when he publicized his Social Security number. So even he wasn't able to prevent it when someone got a hold of his
published
number.
Them on the side of trucks.
Yeah, he did. And of course, someone managed to use it to take out a $500 loan in his name. So we've settled with LifeLock along with a group of other states, and they've agreed to stop making these outrageous claims, and they've agreed to pay $11 million across the country to people in the form of restitution. But our main goal is to get them to stop making promises, you know, that really overstate what they're able to deliver.
Now, primarily, that's the whole business of consumer protection, is to make sure people don't promise more than they can deliver. But there seems to be an almost endless number of cases like this. You're talking about some of the more respected names, even in business, who are,
right.
who are sometimes put a pinky into the pool, so to speak.
Well, that's true. And this is one of the reasons we aggressively enforce, is that we notice that if we don't aggressively enforce, this is exactly what happened in the mortgage market, by the way, then the companies that might normally not engage in the shady behavior start noticing the companies that are, making money. And they say, well, gee, maybe we should start doing that as well. That's exactly the kind of, broken window theory that we saw operate in the mortgage market, where some people started cheating and more people started cheating than everyone in the industry was cheating.
Right.
That's why you have to enforce. It's not unlike being on the road. If you know everyone else is speeding, you're likelier to speed too. But if you notice people being pulled over, you notice everyone else is much likelier to be closer to the speed limit.
Okay, got to ask you a political question.
Okay.
Are you ready?
All right.
The wise money says that if Patty Murray is to be defeated in the Senate race in Washington State, that it's going to have to be a well-known statewide Republican who has run and won, or has run successfully, even if he didn't win.
Yeah.
There are only a handful of them, and you're one of them. Are you entertaining any thoughts of running against Patty Murray in November?
I'm really not. I'm flattered by the attention, but I love what I'm doing right now, and I really don't want to have to uproot my family. But I'll tell you, someone who is looking at it, and I sincerely hope will decide to run, and that's Dino Rossi, because as you said, he's one of those guys who's run, and but for one judge in King County, he would be in his second term as governor right now, I'm convinced. Dino has the name ID, he's got the skills, and frankly, he's been right. I mean, he's warned about the risks of federal overspending and state overspending. He's right. This is the right time for him to run. He's going to make a decision by May. He's already leading Patty Murray in two independent polls that were conducted.
He wins by 8 points.
But then
in one of them, you win also.
Well, that's flattering. But I think Dino is in a solid position if he decides to run. A lot of us are going to come in and help him, and a lot of us are sitting on the sidelines, even though there are now 15 announced candidates
that's
against
right.
Patty Murray. Which I'll tell you, she ought to be worried about, because it's unprecedented. That many people so outraged.
Well, a good many of them, Don Denton among them, said, look, if Dino gets in, they'll step out.
Because Dino starts with the highest name ID you can have, and as I say, he's been right on the issues. I think that's going to resonate with voters.
All right. Don't make a stranger yourself.
See you next time, Mike. Look forward to it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Attorney General Rob McKenna, you're listening to NewsCulp on 920 KXLY.